How do you like waiting 4 years between World Cups? Gian Infantino thinks we want them more frequently.
Every national team had only the possibility to win a title once every 4 or once every 2 years. And if you don't qualify for that competition, then you have to wait again another 4 years. And we know how tragic this is. Maybe it doesn't concern the big countries who are always there.
But is there a bigger power play underway by Infantino to pack the football calendar with his own FIFA tournaments? On Sport Unlocked this week, we'll dissect the big talking points from the FIFA Congress. Hello and welcome to the podcast digesting the best of the week's sports news with interviews and analysis at the end of a week when we've had a very lively FIFA Congress and also a landmark week because of something happened during the week. To explain all alongside me as ever, Rob Harris from the Associated Press, is Martin Ziegler from The Times and Tariq Panja from The New York Times. Welcome along.
Hi guys. Yeah, it's been a historic week. We've met together in the flesh for the first time in more than a year, the three of us together. And I think we had enjoyed some quite nice food, Tariq.
Yes, Martin. It was a fairly impressive curry. I enjoyed myself. Nice to see you all. Nice for you guys to take a trip to my part of the world for a nice meal.
Of course, one place we could have gone that's now opened in London is the place where we can get gold leaf steak from, Salt Bae's new restaurant, which is the favourite eatery of which football executive?
It's hard to look beyond the FIFA president, right, Rob? I mean, you can't move for a selfie or an Instagram post from the chap who butchers steak like no other that I've seen before. Martin, you're familiar with the man's work?
The famous salt sprinkling technique, obviously, I try and replicate that every evening in my own kitchen. But yes, Salt Bae, FIFA president Gianni Infantino, they're big chums. And
so much so that Gianni Infantino actually recorded a promotional video for him for his Instagram while away in Dubai. Yes, this really is the FIFA president Gianni Infantino.
The meat here, like a goal of Maradona, Ronaldo, Messi. Fantastic. Food is like football. Huh? It's passion, it's heart, it's emotion, it's love. And all these ingredients, we can find them here. Thanks to this man.
Mr. Nusret, number one, the best of the best. Unforgettable evening here in Dubai at Nusret. I come back. Legend. He's a legend. Legend number one.
Gianni Infantino certainly seemed to be enjoying himself there. Clips from a couple of recent trips to Dubai. Well, Gianni Infantino is back in his normal setting on Friday of Zurich FIFA HQ for the FIFA Congress, still being held remotely, so we can't go and see him in person. And there was some pretty significant announcements, wasn't there, from it?
Yeah, the announcement that the FIFA Congress, 166 of the FIFA nations, voted in favour of having a feasibility study on having the World Cup every 2 years instead of every four. This is both the men's and the women's World Cup. Obviously, it's a huge challenge to UEFA because it would interfere with their European Championships, which they hold the 2 years alternately to the World Cup. But I think this is quite a significant power play. Do you think, Tariq?
Yeah. Hard to think. Well, you know, it's just a new idea every week, you know, from Gianni. And this isn't the first time we've heard of a 2 year World Cup plan, but you know, it's part of Gianni Infantino's effort to kind of remodel football in the future. This might just be one kind of prong of an all out assault on changing the game as we know it. I think he's talked about global leagues. He's talked about revolutionising the women's game. He's talked about super leagues in Africa. And look, this is another element to it. But again, it just seems like chucking stuff at a wall and hoping something sticks. Because a two-year World Cup creates I don't know. It probably it reduces the value of the competition. The thing about the World Cup for me is it's scarcity factor. You know, a lot of us, you know, from we were kids, you can kind of age your time in life, your moments and milestones in your life with these various World Cups. And if it becomes, you know, every other year or whatever, it kind of loses its importance, perhaps.
And it's not even the first time it's come up under Gianni Infantino's presidency. It was almost 3 years ago that we heard from the Commonwealth president, Alejandro Dominguez, who said then he was lobbying FIFA to have a World Cup every 2 years. And that was at a time when he, as Commonwealth president, was closer to FIFA. Now he's more aligned to UEFA. And it seemed like, you know, he was pushing something that would help undermine UEFA at the time, as we have now with this plan, because what would a World Cup every 2 years do? It would have an effect on the European Championship and all the other regional tournaments that take place.
Yeah, and it was put forward as proposed by the Saudi Arabia Football Association, which is no surprise to anyone who's been following these things, because Gianni Infantino has been buttering them up, or they've been buttering him up, buttering each other up for quite some time.
And actually, at the start of this year, Gianni Infantino was on a trip to Saudi Arabia, and it's time again to dip into the archives, because while he was there, he recorded what effectively was a promotional video for the Saudi government.
What has been created here is amazing. What has been developed is amazing, and this is something that the world should come and see. The Saudi food is delicious. I discovered it again here in the last couple of days. Top, very, very tasty. Different tastes that were not known to me, even though I love Arabic food.
Can't move for promotional videos endorsed by the FIFA president. You'd think he'd be too busy with all these other plans. We've got the Turkish meat company, and now we have the Saudi Tourism Board. Whatever next?
And interestingly, of course, this proposal from Saudi Arabia for a men's and women's World Cup being held every 2 years, Saudi Arabia doesn't even have a women's national team that is ranked by FIFA at all. It doesn't, there is nothing, you know, they're not playing.
Yeah, no, they don't. But, Rob, if you spoke to Gianni Infantino, another thing he endorsed on one of his trips to Saudi Arabia in March this year was a new era for Saudi Arabian women's football. Gianni was there. His chief lieutenant was there. There was a bunch of Saudi delegates as well, and they were looking to create a 24-team Saudi women's league. And I think that's going to be quite a tall order if you've got a country where women's football hasn't really existed, to then say, right, we're going to have 24 teams. But it's part of the strategy for Saudi Arabia as it emerges under Mohammed bin Salman's leadership to present a different face than we've known. It's moving away from the kind of ultra-conservative approach that we've known for decades into a more modern nation. And I guess having a women's league and a women's football program is part of showing the world we're changing, we're different, we're a bit more like you. But at the same time, there's still a lot of questions about human rights over there. A lot of women are in jail. Women who were protesting for the right to drive remain imprisoned and or under scrutiny, under scrutiny from the government there. So it's kind of a very cloudy picture. But you're right, it's a very funny part of the world to be the ones to promote a biannual Women's World Cup.
And Gianni Infantino does certainly spend time with Mohammed bin Salman, who the US intelligence report recently found that the Saudi Crown Prince was likely to approve the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 3 years ago. And Gianni Infantino does seem more readily to engage with Mohammed bin Salman than perhaps some of us when we're trying to find out some questions on the big issues in football.
Yeah, it's been tricky.
Yeah. I mean, even we had a press conference today. I think we all wanted to ask questions. None of us got an opportunity. So that was slightly frustrating because, I mean, you do get the feeling that a lot of what is going on here is an attempt by FIFA to boost their own power and their own income, their own revenues. And what they, it appears to be that they think UEFA is too strong and too rich and too powerful. And so it's all part of a power game, I think, to try and get more money, get more influence. And Gianni Infantino did talk about the effect on countries not qualifying for the World Cup.
And we can take a listen to just what he did say in the press conference about that.
If you are in Africa until today, until this World Cup, out of 54 countries, only 5 qualify for the World Cup. This means that for the vast majority of countries, if you lose one game because of a bad referee decision, and you happen maybe to be in a group with, I don't know, one of the big Nigeria or Egypt or whatever, or Morocco, you have no chance to qualify. What are you doing for the next 4 years? Nothing. Nothing, because you have no chance to qualify.
And why does he not think that the African Cup of Nations is a meaningful competition? If he said that the African teams have nothing if they don't qualify for the World Cup, that just seems bizarre.
Yes, hugely popular tournament.
Tariq, I mean, you've suggested, I see on Twitter, that you actually think having the Women's World Cup every 2 years is a good thing. I'm not convinced about that at all either, actually, because I think that there is a value in having things held not so often, because you have this sort of scarcity value. Mm. So explain why you think it's a good thing.
I just think the place women's football is in, I think the popular interest in the women's game is almost entirely in national team football. We had a really good Champions League final recently, which drew a lot of attention here in Europe, but not enormously, I would say, compared to the eyeballs and the interest the Women's World Cup attracts. And it also allows it to grow in other countries in a way that the club game doesn't even exist. It's only really in Europe and some parts of South America and the US where there is a club game, but it is really not at a scale of the type that the Women's World Cup attracts. So I think if you're trying to grow this, it's not the worst option. You know, we have, like rugby, you have Six Nations every year and it's hugely popular. You have national team cricket matches going central contracts all year round. They're playing, and it does attract a different audience and a big audience. And that's why I think the women's game could sustain a biannual Women's World Cup. Because look, if you look at the men's football, men's professional football, the club game is as popular, if not more popular, than the national team game, you know, across the board, certainly in Europe and South America. And I just don't think the women's game has that level of support yet. And it's not the worst thing in the world to play the most popular version of a nascent sport for the next few years. Might be worth trying.
Surely this would completely damage the European Championships that the UEFA run.
I think there's a huge structural issue. I think there is a lot of anger and frustration inside FIFA that the governing council and the vice presidents on the kind of bureau are people that aren't in step with what FIFA are trying to do. There is clearly a competition between FIFA and UEFA. And I think there are elements within FIFA who are extremely frustrated and angry that people in UEFA can dictate the direction of FIFA when they're competitors. For example, I think there's a statute, a UEFA statute, that says when UEFA members are on the FIFA council, they should be taking their decisions in the best interests of European football. And I suppose on one hand, that's right. But if it's not in the best interest of FIFA, you've got an insane conflict of interest. So there's a huge structural issue. I would have loved to have got him on. Is he happy sharing a board with these people who are kind of pulling in a different direction? But you, Rob?
Well, because this actually goes back to the Sepp Blatter era and the whole arrest 6 years ago and the sort of talk from around FIFA then, and Blatter was, of course, they don't get to pick what was then the Exco. Like Gianni Infantino doesn't get to pick the council, like Boris Johnson can choose his cabinet. They're effectively imposed on him as being elected in by the regional confederation congresses. So he has then around him the vice presidents from the different confederations, as well as other members from those confederations. And UEFA go into those meetings, obviously wanting to protect the interests of European football and their own competitions. And it's why we sort of took so long a couple of years ago to get any sort of agreement on a newer Club World Cup, because UEFA saw it as the threat to the Champions League. Eventually, they did pull back on some of their resistance. There is still obviously that tension between them. But in terms of just even asking him about particularly this World Cup expansion, will they look at all options, not just every 2 years? Why have you just said, should it be every four, every 2 years? Maybe look, should it be every 3 years? Maybe it should be even more infrequent, every 5 years. And actually a study that takes into account fully the interests of the players in particular. What do the players want? And also the fans. Because I think it's been something we've seen in recent weeks, even the UEFA president, Alexander Shefferin, as well as the Glazers pledging to engage with fans as well. We never actually hear Gianni Infantino ever talking about meeting fan groups or meeting fans or engaging them in any way. And yet ultimately, he's paid his many millions from money that is from football.
Yeah,
it's a good point. Do you think, Martin, there should be greater stakeholder consultation? It's a horrible word, stakeholder, but I suppose that's what it is. Do you think they should be talking to more people?
I do think that the my cat is bloody scratching me. I just have to put him out.
Sitting there on your throne, stroking your cat.
Yeah, there you are, Ziggs. There's a mastermind, the man behind it all, the string pull.
We haven't any update on your pigeons.
Oh, it's funny you should ask that. They only laid a pair of eggs on the balcony this afternoon. It was hell up there. Total nightmare.
That answers it for the listeners who've been desperate to know what happened to your pigeon challenges.
Oh, yeah. I'm about to have pigeon children. So, lucky me.
But I can't remember what you asked me. Oh, yeah, about greater stakeholder interaction. I do think that there is, and has been for many, many years, a complete absence of speaking to the fans. So that's something that really needs to change. That was the thing that killed the Super League, wasn't it? They didn't take the fans into account. So, and actually, this week you've been writing about the Super League, Tariq, haven't you? The fact that there was an understanding amongst the Super League clubs, or many of them anyway, that actually they thought that FIFA was on board with their idea.
All these whispers have been around for a while. Finally, we're able to kind of try and put it together this week that FIFA, codenamed W01 by the backers of the Super League, had been involved in the talks and with them. And with some of the clubs about how they might be willing to endorse it. In fact, in one of the contracts, it said the support or the sponsorship, if you would, or the protection of this organ, W01, FIFA, was an essential requirement for Super League to succeed. And there were talks directly with FIFA officials, including with Matthias Grafström, I would say, who is the Deputy Secretary General of FIFA and probably the closest aide to Gianni Infantino. So he probably knew all about it and finally managed to speak to the owner of one of the 12 teams who said that the company known as A22, who were putting it all together, were saying they had FIFA's backing. They wanted to say, well, hang on a minute, let's check for ourselves, do our due diligence, make sure we're not being sold a pup by these guys, because there might just be, marketing talk, etc. And they checked it out themselves, this person said. And yeah, they were getting warm words that under certain conditions, a Super League would be possible. It was only on January the 21st this year when FIFA put out a statement with the other confederations saying they would oppose a closed breakaway, that they were like, hang on a minute, we were talking to this guy. But even then, in that statement, there were enough loopholes to suggest that they could go ahead if there were kind of accessibility options for other teams. And if you noticed, when the final thing was launched, well, terrible launch, as we remember, but had five spaces for teams who are not permanent members. And I think a lot of that is because of the chats they had with FIFA.
And one of the questions I would have actually put to Infantino today is, while he says he opposes anything that's a breakaway from the system, well, actually, would a Super League be a breakaway if there was FIFA backing for it? Because it would stay within the structures of world football. As we see the fact that Infantino is advancing plans for an African Super League. And some of the origins of this actually stem back to a meeting in November 2019 when the Real Madrid president Florentino Perez arrived at FIFA headquarters to meet with Gianni Infantino. And that's the day we discovered that he was president of a new body called the World Football Club Association. With him also that day, I believe, was a Spanish figure, Anas Langrahi, who would go on to become the general secretary of the Super League. And was
Anas Langrahi actually was the head of A22, the company that was putting the Super League project together. He'd been working on it for 2 or 3 years up until we got to this point. So this thing has been in the works a long time. And in Gianni Infantino, when he was asked whether he'd been talking to this group, he went round the houses, etc. But he said he had been talking to this. That was my takeaway. I don't know about you two. He said he had been talking to them.
No, he didn't deny at all that he'd been talking to them. He said, "Oh no, that's what I do. I talk to clubs, and I've been talking. I talk to clubs about Super League even when I was at UEFA. That doesn't mean I support it." But so it basically accepting he had been in fairly lengthy talks with them about it. And if he wasn't in favour of helping them in some way, then he clearly didn't get his message across well enough.
And he was very determined to say he was not conspiring with them in some way. Let's take a listen.
There was absolutely no collusion.
Sorry, we do seem to have the wrong clip there. This is Gianni Infantino.
Doesn't certainly mean in any way whatsoever that FIFA was behind, was colluding, was plotting. I know many clubs. I speak with clubs for many years, since my days at UEFA. And when speaking to European clubs, the Super League topic always is a topic for discussion, always. Everybody in football knows that. So let's, you know, not play games here. And everybody in football knows that for years and years, some clubs are studying and preparing for this or similar projects. In the 16 years I was in UEFA, we always managed to manage that. And I can tell you that there were projects that were far more advanced than the one we have seen recently. But with dialogue, with discussion, we managed, of course, to find always solutions. At FIFA, it is also my responsibility and our responsibility to hear, to meet, to discuss with football stakeholders. This means with our member associations, our leagues, our clubs, the players, the coaches, everyone, big, medium, small.
But one thing you said that was really curious, and I would have loved to follow up on this stuff. Unfortunately, we don't get to talk to these people that often, and when we do send questions, we don't really get them answered. But he said something really, really interesting. He said, well, in his time in football, particularly when he was in UEFA, he'd seen ideas that were far more developed than this one. And I would love to hear what those were, because this thing was actually launched on the 18th of April publicly. This thing had a 4 billion kind of bank loan guaranteed from JP Morgan. And you know, this thing also started litigation in Madrid, which is ongoing. I'd love to know another Super League project that was far more developed than this, because he claimed there were several that were far more developed. He didn't really tell us, did he?
I thought that was absolutely bizarre, that, because we had the Super League with 12 of the top clubs signing legal contracts to go into it. We've had nothing like that before. I'm not quite sure what he's talking about.
And yet at the same time, today he was criticising people who spread rumours about him and about FIFA as if he has no platform to talk about these things. Yet I've been asking for several months in various iterations, giving him the platform as well to clean things up about his role. We all have been asking those questions, and yet he has not chosen to. We've had the vague statements and things that are sort of not choosing to reflect back on what he might have been involved with. And yet he often turns fire on the media as if he doesn't have a platform to be able to clarify himself.
So you know, it's not the first time he's trained his fire on the media. Or, you know, all most people are trying to do is do their work in good faith and try and report the news and tell it. Look, there is a conflict here between various individuals and organisations in football, and we're trying to tell that story. And he's part of it. And it's not the first time he's done this, Rob. I think we were in Bahrain just shortly. He'd been FIFA president for maybe a year, slightly more. It was a FIFA Congress. And he made a speech which was extremely disparaging. And he used typical language of people at the time who want to kind of diminish the role of the media.
Fake news, alternative facts, these terms did not exist until some time ago. They have become en vogue in recent periods. And there are a lot of fake news and alternative facts about FIFA as well circulating. FIFA bashing has become a national sport, especially in some countries. And I understand also why. And it was right. And it was right. But FIFA has changed now. This is a new FIFA. We are new people here. And we act with facts.
Well, and at the time, he was asked in the press conference afterwards, could he give some examples that supported his outburst about fake news? And he couldn't do. Certainly the headline on my piece that day was Infantino blames fake news for FIFA woes, offers no cases.
Was he borrowing the fake news term from somebody or somebody famous, or was it actually Trump who borrowed it from Infantino?
So I think it might be not the worst opportunity right now maybe to talk about FIFA's communications issues. They've been looking for a chief communications officer for, I don't know, almost a year now, and they haven't managed to fill the post. Seems like they've hired headhunters again after the first attempt has sort of ended in failure. If ever an organisation needs to tell its story and needs to communicate better, the last year or so has kind of shown, it's FIFA. What is happening there?
Well, it's a question actually when we talk about comms, and this probably came up around the Super League as well, when things like PR failure come up, it implies the blame is always actually on the comms department, or the comms officials themselves, yet the direction has to be set from the top. So even if FIFA do appoint a new chief communications officer, how much actually are they being empowered from the very top, from Infantino, to speak openly, to actually give full information as required, to give the complete picture of the way FIFA's being run? And one of the big issues facing them in the coming months is the build-up to the 2022 World Cup, and human rights questions were brought up at the FIFA Congress on Friday.
We have a request to take the floor by the president of the Finnish Football Association, Mr. Ari Lahti, please.
With our own eyes, we have witnessed the efforts and initiatives put in place to improve workers' conditions. But we have also observed and discussed the poor housing conditions, inadequate payment of wages, and lack of access to courts and tribunals for migrant workers. During these visits, we have been asked by the migrant workers in Qatar not to leave them alone. And we will not. In December this year, we plan yet another visit to Qatar, seconded by trade union representatives and human rights organizations. Finally, I want to repeat that we engage in these matters because we care. We care for the human rights situation for the workers in Qatar. We care for the football lovers in the world looking towards the World Cup 2022 as a beacon of joy. We care for the football community, and we want to take seriously our responsibility also in this respect when organizing the FIFA tournaments. And we care for the legacy left in Qatar after the final whistle is blown next year.
It is a priority for FIFA. It is a priority for Qatar as well, and you have been witnessing it. I'm sure that the World Cup will be the best ever World Cup, but it will also be a World Cup which leaves a real social legacy.
New questions around rights in the 2022 World Cup host nation this week, with a case causing deep concern.
Yeah, this is really an interesting one, and a quite worrying one. A Kenyan security guard who was kind of blogging about worker rights under a pseudonym, a chap called Malcolm Bedali, He's taken into custody and it hasn't been heard from since May the 5th. Now, human rights groups have been asking for information about Malcolm Bidali, and the Qatari government have offered very little, apart from saying he has allegedly violated Qatar's security laws and regulations. Now, this is a kind of really worrying development, because one of the few workers who has been shedding light on the treatment, he talked about living in cramped circumstances, delayed wages, etc. But you know, he's also talked about, I guess, some of the green shoots there as well. Yeah, it's not been all negative. He talked about how some of the conditions had improved over the years, and the fact that they have now done this and taken him into custody without explaining why reflects extremely badly on them. But one of the things I noticed, which is kind of interesting, it tells you maybe how Qatar might have changed a bit as well, is some of the local news channels and media there, Doha News, Al Jazeera, are reporting on the case and describe it as concerning. So perhaps, you know, that's a bit different. But Martin, we do need to know what's happening, right?
Yeah, that's really positive. I mean, it's quite interesting that within minutes of me tweeting about this, I had an email from the government communications office in Qatar, with a sort of fairly bland statement saying he'd been taken into custody for, as you say, violating Qatar's security laws and regulations, not even allegedly violating, but and they it sounds like Qatar also have also appointed a London-based person to work for their government communications office who's sort of dealing with that. But when I asked, made further inquiries as to exactly what he had done to deserve this arrest, they refused to say. So it is very concerning, and I think it's actually putting a strong spotlight on Qatar ahead of the World Cup. And it is pretty embarrassing, actually, if they don't do something to explain themselves, because silence does not work in these situations. You have to explain yourself, otherwise you end up being seen as a very, very repressive regime.
Yeah, it's interesting. Al Jazeera, who are the state-owned broadcaster in Qatar, do actually highlight, even in their report, that just days before his arrest, Bidali made an online presentation to civil society groups on the state of migrant workers in Qatar, giving his experience as a guard there. And interestingly, we've been hearing as well from James Lynch, who's a director at the rights group Fair Square Research and Projects, who says Qatar have made a lot of steps to reform its labour system. But when we have a migrant worker speaking out about his experiences, sharing his experience and calling for change in a fully peaceful manner, we see them being shut down and disappeared. And these are the types of growing issues that we're not hearing a very vocal public response from Qatar, but have a potential damaging reputational knock-on effect ahead of the World Cup, with players and teams facing pressure from fans because it's such a high-profile area.
Yeah, if Qatar think this is going to go away before the World Cup, then they're in for a rude awakening, because it's just going to get more and more intense, as it should.
But, I mean, you know, particularly when they do actually have a story to tell about the changes that they have brought in, but it's one they don't actually really articulate, which allows this sense to continue, the fact that there are still major issues, which are obviously highlighted by this week's incident. Yet another headache for FIFA.
Speaking of headaches, and again, staying in the Middle East, there are some doubts now over the big boxing bout in Saudi Arabia, set to be between Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua. That was going to be one of the biggest grossing fights in recent times. Build a special stadium to host this, given that's what they do over there. And there's been a spanner in the works in the form of Deontay Wilder. He had an arbitration case in the US. He said he was due to have a third fight with Tyson Fury, and the arbitrators agreed. And they said this fight needs to take place by the middle of September, which is when when the fight with Joshua was slated for. So that looks like it's off. And Deontay Wilder has said, and it's not the worst bit of business if you can get it done. I'll take $20 million for it to be called off. That's not a bad idea. $20 million and not be punched in the face. You'd take that, wouldn't you, Zeke?
Well, I mean, I'll take $20 million and be punched in the face by you, Tarek.
That's an offer. Maybe there's some communications officers out there who would take the offer on the table.
But yeah, I mean, just on that, I mean, this, again, it's like all roads lead to that part of the world, right, Rob? Whatever sporting event, we talked last week about a golf super league there as well, didn't we? Is that where all the money in sport is right now, given the impact of the pandemic in sort of countries that normally invest in sports?
And of course, just next week will be the Champions League final, the first for Manchester City. And the reason they've made it to Porto to play Chelsea is because of the influx of cash from Abu Dhabi since 2008, which transformed the club. They were not a club in 2008 that was going to be anywhere near the Champions League.
No, absolutely not. They've spent that money wisely, but you know, let's not be under any illusions that without that massive cash injection, they wouldn't be where they are. And to be fair to them, they'd say, well, look at all the other teams. The ones that are successful are the ones that spend money, and we should be allowed to. The question is, you know, how much is too much, and does it matter where the money comes from?
And we had UEFA's benchmarking report this week, which interestingly heralded the end of financial fair play as we know it. Alexander Schäferin, the president, talked about a review of what was going to happen, saying that the sort of break-even system no longer works in the post-pandemic world because clubs have lost so much money, and talked about a new system which would lead to significant reductions in wages and transfer fees. I mean, it's easy to say that. How do you achieve it?
Rob, he's talked a good game since he's been the UEFA president, right? Since 2015, 16, whenever he came in, he talked about equalising the game, making it more chances for the medium and small clubs, improving competitive balance, etc., etc. But he's saying all the right things. We haven't actually ever seen anything.
I mean, he's talked a lot about a luxury tax while UEFA president, which if you do overspend, particularly on your payroll, then effectively you have to pay an amount that then is redistributed to other teams, but it's never happened. But it is part of the ongoing changes still to the existing Champions League. We still have that new format still to be introduced in 2024, and the final parts of that still to be put into place as we still deal with the fallout from the Super League.
I'd say one of the things Matt would give FIFA credit for here is they've actually tried to tackle the transfer market in some of this. They had the third round of reforms announced this week, and one of the interesting things was they were going to limit loans, which might sound like a small thing, but I think it's quite a significant thing. So if it prevents teams, big teams, from hoarding a load of talent, it means you'll be able to spread more players to more teams, you know, around Europe, around the world, around your country. You have a bit more competition. Probably, in my view, you may disagree, there hasn't been another time in football history where there's been more talent sat on the bench doing nothing at big clubs than ever before. It would be nice to see some of these guys get games. It might not be for the top two or the top three in the countries, but they'll be improving the chances of the other ones.
Particularly at Chelsea, in the Champions League final next week, so many players they've got out on loan, dozens of them, many who've barely have ever played for the first team. But that's what you can do when you've got the wealth of Roman Abramovich there.
Yeah, it's particularly an English club thing, actually. I think they're having this idea of having lots of players out on loan and using it as a way of making money, as well as almost denying other clubs the talent in a way, because if you have them under your control, they can't go to your rivals.
But Zeke, would you say it's now coming home to roost a bit because the pandemic has hit the balance sheet so hard? Or some of these clubs that are losing a lot of money are stuck with a bunch of players that they're paying salaries for, and they were hoping to speculate on them, and the transfer market's collapsed. So I don't know, they're going to have to find a way of moving these guys on, which they probably, it almost is like a bit of karma, perhaps, for stockpiling so many players.
Probably, but on the other hand, they do tend to be the clubs which have aren't too bothered too much about the losses because they own, you know, they have either an oligarch or a state funding them in the background. So it's probably not so much of an issue for those. I mean, I do think that there is a big problem with how do you control spending on wages. If you bring in for example, if you say you can only spend a 55% of your revenue on wages, that effectively locks in a system which benefits the big clubs. In fact, as we saw, that was one of the aspects of the Super League, wasn't it? So,
no, I agree. That's a big problem. Absolutely. Yeah. You're dead right, because you don't want to pull the drawbridge up, because this whole thing, sport in general, is not very interesting if you don't have competition. So it's that tension between having competition and not bankrupting football clubs. But isn't this what these organisations like FIFA and UEFA are for, to think about these things rather than to kind of row with each other or to come up with new zany competition ideas, etc.? Isn't this the matter at hand? Developing the game maybe at grassroots level and also trying to save it and protect it and sort of look after it at the elite senior level. It seems they've taken their eye off the ball.
Yeah, to maintain the actual lifeblood of the game, to ensure its viability, to ensure also its competitiveness as well, in fact. Yet, certainly, as we loop back to the start, some of the talks that Gianni Infantino was in or not with those Super League clubs was actually about close relations, about the elite and helping perhaps the rich get richer, while on the face of it, he tries to talk about helping the game overall. Ultimately, so many are seduced by the power and the money.
Yeah, he said one thing today as well, which was I thought was really interesting. And again, if they were able to get their messaging right, they might have been able to tell that story better. And I'd like to know a little bit more about it. They've started this African schools program all across Africa. FIFA are a kind of part of the curriculum, it seems, to get football into schools. And again, I think that's exactly the sort of thing that world governing bodies should be doing and focusing on, and also trying to tell that story. I didn't know much about it. He mentioned it in briefly in passing today. But isn't that what they should be sort of shouting from the rooftops and sort of telling some of these stories?
I think it's an issue that many bodies, particularly like FIFA, have, which is they don't know how to tell credible, positive news, because it either gets overblown in full of hyperbole and press releases rather than actually trying to talk about the positives, or there are ongoing trust issues or other questions that the governing body is facing that they're not properly addressing, which impacts the ability to try to tell the other stories about perhaps how they are introducing positive changes. But it's hard to be positive about the situation in Japan as the IOC grapple with so many ongoing coronavirus concerns about the pandemic games and just whether or not they can go ahead.
Yeah, it has. But there was a unequivocal statement from the IOC's vice president, the fellow in charge of the Tokyo Olympics from their side, John Coates, the Australian. He said, absolutely yes, when asked if the games were going to go ahead. So as far as they're concerned, this is happening. To me, it seemed, I don't know, what it has to be so awful that, you know, the worse than anything we've ever seen now, for the IOC to even countenance not having the Olympics. Don't you get that sense?
It's not the... the IOC are never going to call it off because, you know, that's their whole raison d'etre, isn't it? It's like they're not going to do it. But, I mean, interestingly, I sort of reading this week, reports coming out of the Japanese media saying Japan faces a financial catch-22. In that if they cancel the Olympics themselves, they're then liable to pay the IOC hundreds of millions, if not billions of pounds in compensation for lost sponsorship and broadcast income. So they've already spent a huge amount of money on the games, obviously. And I think they don't want to sort of lose face, and B, they don't want to spend another huge amount of money in compensation for the for calling it off themselves, even though 82% of the population don't want it to happen.
What does that make the IOC look like, Rob? If you've got a country that's in the midst of a pandemic, 82% of the people don't want it, and they're forcing them with a gun or the threat of a $1 billion charge to force it through, if what Martin's saying is correct there. What do you think of that?
I think they're not really getting the message across significantly that actually the reason why they need to generate this cash, the IOC, is to fund the National Olympic Committees and the various sports. I mean, so many of them are reliant on the cash that they receive via the IOC from the Olympic. And actually, then there'll be a lot of sports and National Olympic Committees potentially facing significant financial issues if they don't get this cash from the Tokyo Games, which shows us why it's so important to get the Games going ahead. Even, I mean, Tokyo, they're really struggling to actually vaccinate the population. Just a couple of percent of the population of Japan has even been vaccinated. Compare it to, I think, 70% of the UK that have had their first jabs of the adult population.
Yeah, I think you have to read between the lines, actually, with what's coming out of Tokyo. So I was studying it fairly closely. And from the outcome of the Coordination Commission meetings that were taking place this week, to me, it seems that they're going to have a really massive cutback in people who are intending to go. One of the organising committee staff was talking about that only the people who are essential for the Games will actually go ahead. So I think a huge amount of cuts in the number of media looks likely. It's very late in the day for that to happen, but I think that looks like it's gonna take place. We've already had a lot of the broadcasters have cut their own delegations by a lot. The BBC, who sent 455 to Rio, they're sending less than 100 people to Tokyo, and I think there's going to be other cuts imposed on the rest of the media and other what are viewed as non-essential delegates from the National Olympic Committees.
The number I heard, Martin, it was interesting. They said they expect 40,000 foreigners to come with athletes and delegations, media, etc. And that's about half the number that would normally attend an Olympics. But even that might be on the high side, given the scale of the pandemic and the risks that this still poses.
Yeah, talking of the Olympics, we've also had Adam Jamili, the British sprinter, talking about the Rule 50, which bans political demonstrations of any kind at the Olympics. He said that all hell will break loose if they're banned from taking the knee, for example, on the podium. And he says he will do that if he wins a medal. So this is going to be a really interesting challenge if and when the Games go ahead and we see this thing's happening. You know, we all remember Tommy Smith and John Carlos on the podium 1968. You may not actually remember the time, guys, because it was before you were born, obviously. But it was an iconic moment, and this will be a really interesting thing in Tokyo, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ziggs. I think these organisations need to get with the times. Athletes are realise they're activists too, and they're going to do that rather than clamping down and penalising them for protests on issues which most people are aligned with. They should let them have their say.
And I was at grounds this week for the return of fans, Wembley for the FA Cup final and Chelsea against Leicester on Tuesday night. And one notable thing was some booing of taking a knee. And that certainly alarmed some of the Leicester players very close to me on the bench who were looking up and seeing it from the Chelsea fans. Well, it's been a busy week there with so much around FIFA. One day, hopefully, we will be back face-to-face at these events where it's much easier to question the delegates and the FIFA leadership. But at least we got to meet up this week.
Yeah, great food, great company. Here's to next time.
Really enjoyed it, guys. The kulfi ice cream is on me next time.
Excellent. And most importantly, thank you everyone for listening as ever. If you're enjoying us, please rate, review and subscribe to us on whichever platform you're listening to us on. Whatever sport you're watching in the days ahead, enjoy it and speak to you soon. Goodbye for now.